Last week we looked at, well, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at chapter 4 and 5, and we discussed the prayers of Sukadeva Goswami in praying to the Lord for the ability and the blessings to be able to answer nicely the questions asked of him by Parikkhita Maharaj. And he was going to answer those questions by reciting the conversation between Lord Brahma, the first created being within the universe, and his son, one of his ten sons, Narada Muni. And we discussed in answering the questions of Parikkhita Maharaj, Lord Brahma revealed to Narada Muni that there was someone above Brahma who's responsible for the creation of the universe, and that person is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, who appears in his expansion as Mahavishnu or Karanadakshaya Vishnu, who glances over the material energy, which is his own energy, as he lays upon the Karana ocean, the causal ocean, and he glances at the material energy and activates the material energy, and from his breathing the various universes emanate and are then covered by the different layers of the Mahatattva and expand into the universal shells, and then the Lord as Gavadakshaya Vishnu enters within those universes. So in this way Lord Brahma answered some of Narada Muni's questions. And we discussed in some detail various aspects of cause and effect that is set in place by the Lord's glance to gradually produce the various ingredients of material creation. Is anyone game enough to do a short summary of that of creation? Is that very simple? Very simple. Yeah, just a very short summary of the creation. Material nature of there within Prakriti, so they become agitated by the mind, and that causes the modes of material nature to become activated, and the Mahatattva is produced. Mahatattva consists of how many elements? 16. False ego. So the Mahatattva, we understood initially, it's in a state of equilibrium, the three modes. It becomes predominant in the mode of goodness, and then actually the manifestation of the Mahatattva is predominantly the mode of passion, rajas. So when by further interaction the mode of ignorance becomes prominent, within the Mahatattva, then the false ego manifests. Yes. That's right. Yeah. Were you here when we did that? Yep. Yep. We had that diagram to show that. Although the Mahatattva may be predominantly in the mode of ignorance, still, there are the three modes there within the Mahatattva. And from the mode of goodness, certain things are created from the mode of passion, predominance, certain things that manifest from the mode of ignorance, certain things manifest. So from the mode of... What's that?
From ignorance, the sound.
And the sound, and then the elements. Yep. So there is the subtle elements of the elements, such as sound, touch, what, and they produce the gross element. Yep. From subtle, so sky. So there's ether, sky, fire. Water, earth, like that, each with their subtle manifestation, and we understood that each successive manifestation has all the qualities of the previous manifestations plus one extra quality. Yeah. And from the mode of passion, you get a hankering in the mode of passion produces the senses, and the intelligence, and a hunger in the mode of goodness produces the mind and the demigods. Yeah. So there was a succession, and of course that is in the chart, in the student handbook, you've got that there. And we talk about Adi-Devic, Adi-Atmic and Adi-Bhautic, technical there. I have to follow up on that class to move to that part there. Alright. So, today we're going to chapters 6 and 7. We'll be looking at verses between 18 to 22 of the sixth chapter. In essence, this sixth chapter describes aspects of the Virata Purusha, the universal form of the Lord. The Virata Rupa is the universal form, and that universal form is coming from the Virata Purusha, the person, Purusha, who is Gavadakshai Vishnu. Yes, the Virat Rupa is the form of the universal form, and the Virat Purusha is the person. So there is a person who is activating that universal form, and that Virat Purusha is Gavadakshai Vishnu. Yeah, Gavadakshai Vishnu, yes.
But isn't it the universal form that
It's imaginary in the sense that it's not an eternal manifestation. It's a form that doesn't manifest in the spiritual world. In that sense, it's imaginary. That's right. It's not imaginary in that sense. In other words, no, the form, the universal form, is an actual form of the which manifests. You see. We have Mahavishnu has manifested the Mahatattva by glancing at the material energy, and that Mahatattva means that the modes of material nature begin to manifest the 16 essential ingredients of creation, which are index. Mahatattva, so defined ego ingredients, 646. Okay. Now, the creative instruments are 11, the ingredients are 5, and all of them are products of Mahatattva. That didn't tell us properly. 16 principles of creative matter and instruments. That doesn't give as much of a definition as I'd like. Anyone see other definitions of Mahatattva? Defined in 10. a definition written down there. We're just looking at the, make sure we exactly know the ingredients of the Mahatattva. Does it tell you what the 16 ingredients are? Same with it. It does. Can you read that? Yeah. Yes. Is that leading to the description of the 24 elements? Because there's a list of 24 elements, but there's 16 elements that are there before the 24 elements. Got it in here. I want to see the 16 ingredients. What about looking verse Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text number 3. Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text number 3. Here it tells you it's going to list the ingredients and it doesn't actually list them.
What are we looking for?
16 elements of the Mahatattva. Mahatattva. My understanding would be it is the five elements the five working senses, the five knowledge gathering senses, and the mind. That's my understanding. But I want to see it written somewhere. So it's not in there. No? Type in 16 ingredients. Yeah, this is the Bhagavatam.
And you want a verse for that?
Yeah. You get some hits on that? By the 16, namely five elements, the five perceptive sense organs, and the five working senses, and the mind. That's in there. Yeah.
That's in the purple.
Yeah, that's 2917. So that's what I 2917. It is listed somewhere else, I just can't seem to find it. But for his material creative energies, he is served by four, so it gives you a list if we take four. 16, when we say 16, we refer to the Mahatattva, and that is the five elements: earth, water, air, fire, air and sky. The five perceptive organs, the eye, ear, nose, the tongue and skin, and the five working sense organs, the hand, the leg, the stomach, the evacuation outlet, and the genitals, and the mind. So they're the 16. Then, if we say, we can also say 24 elements, which is the list that you were looking at. Good. 25, we can either include the fine, sometimes the jiva. The question was that the Mahatattva, there are 16 elements in which the seeds of the universe are covered by. Within the Mahatattva. And although the ingredients are there, they're not actually assembled properly in a coordinated way. Not only are they not properly assembled, but they're not coordinated properly into activity. So when Garbhadakshay Vishnu enters within the universe, he actually lays down within on the bottom half of the universe for 1,000 years of his time. And it's during this time that he actually manifests the universal form. And in manifesting the universal form, the actual ingredients of universal creation are properly assembled and coordinated by the Bharata Purush, or the person, Supreme Lord. So, you know, there's a difference between the Virata Rupa in one sense and the Virata Purush. And the Virata Rupa is the universal form which is manifested by the universal person, Gavadakshaya Vishnu. In another sense, they're one because the energy, the ingredients of universal creation are factually the energy of the Lord. So, you know, we can say that the universal person and the universal form are one because the energy and the energetic. At the same time, we can also distinguish between the manifestation of the energy and the person remains intact. In other words, his person does not become broken up into pieces that actually create the universe. His person remains intact. The person is, of course, they feel that by, you know, for instance, if you get a piece of paper, you tear off into so many different pieces of paper, then you no longer have one piece of paper, you just have many, many different pieces. So the universal person remains a complete whole person, even though so many different parts are coming from him to assemble the universe like that. So the universe is, it's not imaginary in the sense that there is no form there. We see that from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu comes the lotus stem, and that lotus stem actually is all the three planetary systems are actually contained within that lotus stem, on which Brahma sits at the top in Brahma Loka. So just as a lotus flower actually has a form, the lotus that emanates from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu is not imaginary, and all of the universes are actually situated within that lotus stem, which actually manifests as the universal form. It's imaginary in the sense that it's a form that doesn't exist in the spiritual world. It's a form that exists in the material world, and then that particular form is sometimes wound up, just like our material body is considered imaginary in the sense that it's there for some time, but it's not our eternal identity. So it's an imaginary form of us, our material body. If we think of ourselves as this material body, that's our imagination, because we're not this material body. Our actual identity is something different. So if we think that the Lord's form is the universal form, that's imagination. The Lord is not that form. He remains the Virat Purush, a transcendental person. Even when the universal form is wound up, in essence, the Virat Purusha, you know, that personality is not lost. He's an eternal personality. That is, you know, Gavadakshaya Vishnu, who's actually non-different from Mahavishnu, who's non-different from Sankirshan, who's non-different from Narayan. So that person eternally exists. So it's imagining in the sense that, you know, if we say that Narayan's form is the universal form, that's imaginary. No, Narayan's form is eternal within the spiritual sky. And, you know, Narayan also manifests his form as Mahavishnu, Shiradakshaya Vishnu. Their eternal transcendental forms, his personality, you know, that person never ceases to exist. He exists before the universal creation, he exists during universal creation, and he exists after universal creation. Whereas the personers, they think that Narayan is the imagination. No, that's the fact. They think that his personality is imaginary, that it doesn't actually exist. He's on the transcendental platform, it's either void or impersonal. So they're thinking that, you know, he's the imaginator. Actually, the imagination is the universal form. It is the universal form is like a reflection of the form of the Lord. So because the actual form and personality and qualities of the Lord exist, when that person's characteristics are reflected on the material energy, we get the universal form. So the reality is the Supreme Lord, and the reflection is the universal form. Not that the reflection of the Supreme Lord on the material energy is the reality and his actual, like that, you see. So it's a case of saying that if we look in the mirror, which one's the real one? Is it the reflection is the imaginary one, or is it the other one? So we understand that the reflection is the imaginary form. So therefore, in the same way, the universal form is a reflection of the Lord on the material energy. That's the imaginary form. It's like that. But the reflection is there. If you look in a mirror, that you can actually see a form. So in the same way, you know, the characteristics of the Lord do manifest a form, you know, but because it's reflecting on the material energy, it's imaginary, but there is a form there. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's not in the sense that someone looks in the mirror and they can't see anything, and they just imagine something in there. That's because it's not a mirror, it's just a piece of glass. You know? It's not like that. So actually in chapter 6, you know, the first part, is actually again a discussion on the universal form. Now, chapter 6 is called the Purusha Shukta Confirmed. The Purusha Shukta is a very famous prayer, an essential prayer from the Vedas. It might take slightly different forms in some of the Vedas. Essentially 16 verses or sometimes 18. Actually, the Purusha Shukta is such an important prayer that a lot of the Vedas expand from that prayer, you could say. And it is a prayer which glorifies Gavadakshay Vishnu. I'll read you the translation, if you like, of those. And you'll see that practically all of this has been mentioned in chapter 6. Text number 1. The Supreme Lord's universal form has 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, and 1,000 feet, for he contains all living entities. Having pervaded the universe completely to give it existence, and being independent, he extended himself beyond the universe by 10 fingers. So, you know, the universal form, he has thousands of heads and thousands of eyes, thousands of feet. One, because he manifests as all the, you know, individual living entities. And also, because Gavadakshay Vishnu manifests himself in each and every universe. And also because the expansion of Ananta Sesha, who he lies upon, has thousands of heads. So in this way, in so many different ways, he is known to have thousands of heads, thousands of eyes. And then again, he expands as the super soul within each and every atom, and that is also, you know, so Kshiradakshaya Vishnu is not different from Gavadakshaya Vishnu. And that way also he has thousands of heads, aren't like this. The universe, past, present, future are but manifestations of the Supreme Lord's Purusha expansion. The Supreme Lord's Purusha expansion. So, the universal form is expanded from the Purush, or that Supreme Person. Though he is the Lord of immortality, he has manifested himself as the Purush in the universe so that the Jivas may enjoy material fruits. I'm reading from the Purusha Shukta, which is, this is actually found in our Pancha Pradeep, in our deity worship manual. Second volume, page 76-89. The past, present and future universes are manifestations of the Lord's powers, but the Lord himself is much greater. All the living beings of the universe are but one quarter portion, and the eternal nature in the spiritual sky exists in three quarters portions. So that's, you know, verses 18, 19 or something, 20. In this sixth chapter, you see that discussion there. All of these verses, sometimes Prabhupada mentions Purusha Shukta in a purport. The Acharyas, especially Vishwanath Chakravarti, the court, will mention each time one of these verses is discussed in some of the verses. He'll tell you that this verse is discussing this particular line of the Purusha Shukta. So the Purusha Shukta is mentioned there. From the Lord the universe was born, and in that universe was born the Virata Purush, the super soul of the universe. We see that Mahavishnu manifests the universes, and then he expands this Gavadakshay Vishnu within the universe. The Virata Purush grew and produced the earth and the bodies of the Jivas. The Devatas, the first beings manifested, performed a mental sacrifice to complete the creation. For this sacrifice they used the Virata Purush, the raw ingredients of the material world, as the offering. Spring was the ghee, summer the fuel wood, and autumn the offering. Now this part here I think comes in at about text 24 or something like that. Is it 23 maybe? 24. Right, that, you know, in the beginning Lord Brahma was there. Now there's a little bit of a jump here, in the sense that we have a universe, a universal shell. Gavadakshay Vishnu is obviously there. Brahma has manifested. The lotus has manifested, but there's no material creation. And Lord Brahma wants to worship the Lord as he's been instructed, in order that he can manifest the universe, but there's no ingredients even for the worship of the Lord. So those ingredients he literally takes from the universal form itself in order to do the worship. And we understand from this, it's a very essential, you know, one, it's an essential understanding that we must worship the Lord, because he has produced everything, so everything is meant for his pleasure. He's the proprietor of everything. Brahma has understood that, you know, I am taken birth in this universe, I have nothing. Everything belonging to the Lord and manifested by the Lord is for his pleasure. Therefore, I should please him. You know, I am dependent on him. Brahma understood this from the very beginning. I can't do anything. There's nothing I can do. I am completely dependent upon the Lord, and everything is emanating from him. I have nothing. I have no power. I have no ability. I must please the Lord. So, in the very beginning, Brahma understood that we must first offer worship or sacrifice to the Lord. Now, of course, you know, over time that can get lost. But if we follow in the footsteps of Brahma, that point will never be lost. You know, people come into the world now and they think, well, you know, there's so many different things, and there's shopping malls, and there's, you know, credit cards and so many different things like that. So, you know, why worship the Lord? You know, everything's here. Like that. But actually, every single thing that we have, you know, is actually coming from the Lord. And every single person is actually in the same position as Brahma, that, you know, everything we see within creation is, you know, we are dependent upon him to manifest that, and he is a proprietor of that. Therefore, it's meant for his pleasure. You know, therefore we see Bhagavad Gita 5.9. You know, the Lord is the proprietor, the enjoyer, and the supreme friend. Like that. So this is this sets the precedent for every living entity within the universe. He had no ingredients, so he literally had to, whatever ingredients were manifested by the universal form, he utilized that in order to worship the Lord. Spring was the ghee, summer the fuel wood, autumn the offering. In this sacrifice, the blades of kushic grass strewn around the fire for protection from rakshasas were 7. The fuel sticks were 21. The devotees who performed the mental sacrifice tied the Virata Purusha to offer him as the sacrificial animals. The devotees, the sages, the rishis placed the Virata Purusha, the first being in the universe, on kusha grass and sprinkled him with water for purification. In this way they conducted the mental sacrifice using the Virata Purusha. So just as when we do a fire yagya or something like that, they did this initial worship, as described in the Purusha Shukta, that it was a mental worship, from the utilizing the Virata Purusha himself. From that sacrifice, where everything in the universe was sacrificed, yogurt and ghee, and indeed all nourishing foods were produced, it created the animals in the air, the forest and the village. From that ultimate sacrifice, or Savahuta, were born the Rik, Sama, and Yajus, portions of the Vedas, along with the 7 Vedic meters. Horses were born from the sacrifice, along with animals, the 2 sets of teeth, such as donkeys and mules. Cows are also born from the sacrifice, along with goats and sheep. In the mental sacrifice, when they divided up the Vrata Purush, how many parts did they divide? What is stated about his face, arms, thighs and feet? The answer, the Brahmanas arose from the face, the Kshatriyas from his two arms, the Vaishyas from his thighs and the Sudras from his feet. His mind gave rise to the moon, his two eyes, the sun, his breath, Vayu, and his mouth, Indra and Agni. From his navel arose the space between earth and heaven, from his head the heavens, from his feet the earth, from his ears the directions. In this way the worlds were created. I know that great Virat Purush as effulgent as the sun, who stands beyond the darkness of the material creation, having given all the living entities their forms and names, he directs their affairs. So, you know, here, in essence, is describing, in summary, that from worshipping the Lord, actually then the Lord manifested the universal form as a result of this worship that was performed. So this was done before the manifestation. Brahma explained his realization to Indra. Indra, who knows all the living entities in all four directions, explained it to others. One who knows the nature of the Virata Purush becomes immortal even in this life on earth. There is no other path to reach the goal of immortality. In this way, the Devatas conducted the mental sacrifice using the Virata Purush to manifest variety in the world. But that sacrifice, by that sacrifice, both the physical laws of nature and the first spiritual codes of conduct arose. The great souls, by similar mental worship, attained the place of immortality where dwell the Sajjas and Devatas, the first worshippers. Chapter, in essence, Prakrit Maharaj has asked some questions of Sukadeva Goswami, and in order to answer those, he's recited a conversation between Brahma and Narada. And in that conversation, Brahma is going back to the very, very beginning of creation, even before the Virata Rupa manifested, and you know, he's describing how at first they had to worship the universal person. By worshipping the universal person, he manifested an actual universal form, although that supreme person exists independently from it and is always far greater than the manifestation of the universal form. And he is transcendental. That universal person is possessed of so many different wonderful transcendental qualities, even though he manifests the universal form as a result of the initial prayers of Lord Brahma. So, and then in the sixth chapter also, it does begin with a little synopsis of the universal form that was manifested as well. In the beginning, Brahma heard just the sound vibration of, you know, there was darkness. He didn't actually see in the beginning. At some stage, the Lord did reveal himself, both Vishnu and Krishna, to our Brahma anyway. You know, Krishna doesn't always reveal himself necessarily, but Abraham of Krishna also revealed himself. But initially, predominantly, Lord Brahma's contact with the Lord was through the Virata Rupa, the universal form. You know, the universal person is there, although Brahma is not necessarily has the transcendental vision to be able to perceive that Lord. That, you know, so. Mostly his understanding and his perception of the Lord is via the Virata Rupa, the universal form itself, the manifestation, and you know, through Vedic, through teachings that he is getting from the Lord. Any questions or comments? Yes. Yeah, there are situations where Brahma does perceive the Lord, but not all the time. So even in this second canto, we will take up that instruction by the Lord to Brahma and what have you, and also in the third canto we'll look at that a little bit more. The exact occasions when he does, perceive, the presence of the Lord, but it's not, a constant feature that he's always seeing. You know, it's not like, looking at the lotus like that. He's, or even, Kshira Dakshai Vishnu. We see that, when they wanted Krishna to appear, they went to the shore of the milk ocean, which is, where Svetadvipa, which is a Vaikuntha planet within the universe, and they prayed to Vishnu. But generally, even Brahma, they don't see Vishnu, and they offer this Purushashukta prayer. So important it is. Yes, yeah. So we will discuss all of those, but generally, that personal contact is not always there. It's quite rare even for a Brahma. But, there is, the Lord communicates with him through the heart, and sometimes the sound vibration, and empowering him, in this way, he in little ways he gets the understanding of the Lord's presence, and through his intelligence, he is enlightened to understand that he knows that, as a person I have done this, but as we see in this section of the Bhagavatam, he's telling Narada Muni that, the Lord has actually done everything, and really, he's created all the ingredients and everything, and really I'm just doing some tiny little bit of creative work with what the Lord has already done, and I'm doing it with his intelligence and by his guidance and by a reflection of the potency that he's allowing me to have, so he understands the presence of the Lord in that way as well. That there are two different people in this universe. There's me, a tiny, tiny little living entity, which is discussed here in this verse, in this chapter. And then there's the Lord, who he knows exists in so many different ways, both by instruction and by seeing the universal manifestation. So, a lot of these, a lot of the aspects of this topic of creation we will discuss, you know, as we get through the second canto and the third canto as well. So we can fill in a little bit, just to make sure that we understand what we're currently dealing with. The main thing is to understand what we're currently dealing with, to get a bit of an idea that we have been discussing the universal form. It is an actual universal form. It's imaginary in the sense that it's not the Lord's actual form and personality. It's a reflection of his form and personality and character. but it is because the Lord manifests his universal form that all other living entities are able to be awarded their different, you know, bodies, which are, you know, their various senses, you know, the five knowledge acquiring senses, the five working senses, the mind, you know, and the objects of their senses. All of those different things become available because the Lord has manifested his universal form. So, you know, within the universal form, two things are happening step by step. One is that, you know, the entire thing is being manifested in totality. And because everything is being manifested in totality, it's then paving the way for each little individual body and that to be manifested. So, you know, you picture, and say, like we use the example of manufacturing cars, that if we want to manufacture a Holden car, you need to, you know, manufacture the entire, you have to create the entire manufacturing process and ingredients all in one. You don't just make one car at a time, right? That, you know, you get, you're going to make one car, so someone goes to the other country, they dig up the iron, you know, they bring it back, they smelt it down, they turn it, you know, turn it in, they bang it and put it into shape, they make some bolts, they make this, they make each, you know, you imagine each, for each car, you do each individual thing, and then you paint it, you know, with a little bucket, tin of paint, and then when you're finished, all your ingredients are gone, you've got one car, and then you start again. So you go out and get some more iron, you know. So you don't, you manufacture the whole thing in its entirety first, and then by that you've actually set the groundwork for each individual thing to be manifested. So both are going on. Lord Brahma plays a part, especially with we see that in the producing the bodies, literally populating the universe, you know. Populating the universe with all varieties of 8,400,000 different species of life. You know, Brahma has a lot to do with that. But already the senses for all those 8,400,000 different species have been manufactured. See? You know, the raw ingredients are there. Again, just like you may take some metal, you may have some sort of a press machine, you run off a large piece of metal, and that can become, you know, the left rear of the car, and then, you know, from that metal, some becomes the right front, and from that metal. So, you know, that those ingredients, you can make several different types. You know, from the metal, the raw sheets of metal you've got there, you can make, you know, so many different types of cars if the company's set up really well. Same metal, but you can make a sedan, and you can make a station wagon. It's the same metal. So the senses are there, but you know, from those senses you can make 8,400,000 different species of life. So, you know, you assemble ingredients that have, you know, universal application. And you know, the universal form is like that, is that everything required for there to be 8,400,000 different species of life, plus all the different habitats, their requirements for eating, sleeping, mating and defending, all that is actually summed up in 24 ingredients. Right? So the universal form is like that. You know, you've got your sixth, you've got your senses, you've got the elements, you've got the subtle elements, you've got the, you know, objects of the senses like this, and the mind and the intelligence. They're the ingredients, and from that, let's make a whole lot of different species of life. So, two things are happening. You're making the totality and assembling them in such a way that, as required, we create things. Now, Lord Brahma prayed to the Lord in his prayer, and in his answers to Narada Muni, also there's prayers and there's also answering his questions, and you know, there he's describing that, you know, he's saying to Narada that my part is really insignificant, you know, in this whole creation thing. It's really, you know, actually everything is being done by the Supreme Lord. He has unlimited potencies. He's transcendental. Even though he's really manifesting this creation, he's far more powerful than, you know, this whole manifestation that, you know, we see in these verses here. That later, of course, it becomes revealed to Brahma that he's only one Brahma amongst many, many millions of Brahmas, each in their own universe. And then he gets an understanding that if you take all the Brahmas and all the universes, that makes up for just one quarter, approximately, of the manifestation of the Lord, which is a manifestation in the material realm. Whereas if you take the three quarters, you know, approximately, that takes up the, you know, spiritual realm where the Lord lives. So Brahma's understanding, I am so tiny within this whole scheme of things. And not only this universe, but the Lord is actually... you know, we have a look at those verses. Verses 18 to 22. Each one will have their own individual universal form. each one is within, because the universal form is within the universal shell. Our planet, our universe is considered quite small. So, generally we can take it that there'll be a lower, a middle, and an upper. Where the lower planetary systems are generally for very materialistic persons, where there is one may reside there due to a lack of piety. The upper planetary systems are for those due to where they will reap the benefits of great piety, and the middle planetary system is Marcha Loka, or where one literally generates karmic reactions in the middle planetary system, because when you go to the heavenly planets, you're basically just using up your you can create offences and what have you, but generally you're fulfilling a destiny by utilising good karma. You go to the lower planetary systems, and again, you're fulfilling a destiny by utilising impious karma. In the middle planetary systems, you accrue karma to a significant degree, which makes you go up and down. They may, as I say, if the universe is far exceeding, huge, there may be more than 14. It may be bigger, but so it can be, but still the proportions of lower, middle, and upper, fulfill the requirements necessary to for living entities to enjoy, suffer, and actually be responsible for their activities. But I haven't seen it stated that every universe will have 14 exact, because ours is one of the smallest. Some of the universes are huge, massive compared to our universe. So therefore, they can accommodate more. There may be we have to understand that within each universe there will be planetary systems for those who are siddhas, or very very much perfect in austerity and yoga processes and what have you. And then some of those actually become even more elevated in transcendental knowledge, and they may reside on higher planetary systems, and so different living entities have different desires. For some living entities enjoy the dancing and the music and live sort of a heavenly sort of a life, and others more sages, and who live in a state of perfection, somewhat detached from material to some degree. So according to the living entities' different degrees, they will be accommodated in each and every universe, but it may be done in if they're bigger universes with bigger populations, they may need more than 14. But a similar structure will be there to fulfill the requirements. Throughout everything in material creation is a symmetry in that there's always three varieties as a basis. There's always good, bad, and in the middle, because there's sattva, rajas, and tamas. So everything in the material world has those three varieties. You know, fruit, there's good, bad, and in the middle. Men, women, weather, you know, abodes, intelligence, everything has three varieties. But those three varieties, as we know, if we mix the three modes proportionally, we can get then, is it nine? So then there are nine. And then we mix those nine by nine, we get 81. So each universe is a mixture of the modes of material nature. So there is a symmetry in each universe, because they're mixing the same modes to get the various, you know, varieties of good, bad, and in between. Okay. So we see in text number 18, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the controller of immortality and fearlessness. He is transcendental to death. And the fruit of actions of the material world, it is therefore difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Person. Okay, so this is Prabhupada does explain, and quoting the Padma Purana, Tripad Vibhuti, that, you know, the Lord's abode is transcendental, whereas the Padavabhuti, the one quarter, is mundane. So there's a lot of description in that, describing the difference between the transcendental world of three quarters and the material realm of one quarter. One of your homework questions is actually give a brief comparison of the one-fourth and the three-fourths energies of the Lord from verses 19 to 20 in this sixth chapter. And we can see that generally that there is deathlessness, fearlessness, freedom from anxieties of old age, disease, in the kingdom of God. Prabhupada mentions also in the purport that, you know, there is the energies of Sandini, Sambit, and Hridini, or existence, knowledge, and bliss, but in the material world, which is just a reflection of those three transcendental characteristics, we can only experience knowledge, existence, and pleasure very meagerly. It's just like the difference between trying to warm yourself by the sun or trying to warm yourself by a reflection of the sun in the water. It's very meager. See? Therefore, as Prabhupada mentions, factual deathlessness, fearlessness, freedom from old age and diseases are possible only beyond the material spheres. So that's where they exist in properly, not just as a mere reflection. Verse 20, you know, another characteristic of those transcendental realms is that it is especially meant for those who will never be reborn. But those who are attached to family life and who do not strictly follow celibacy vows must live within the three material worlds. So that's another characteristic mentioned in text 20. Basically, it's the abode of the liberated, not the materially attached. In verse 21 describes that the Lord is the Lord, whichever path the jiva takes, the Lord is the master of that realm, whether in the material world or in his liberated state. The Lord still remains the master of that liberated existence of the living entities. It's not that when we become liberated that the Lord is no longer our master or controller, or that we are independent. People may think, I'll become liberated, become independent from everything. But no, even in the liberated state, one is completely dependent in one's existence upon the Supreme Lord. So, Lord Brahma is describing that, you know, the Supreme Lord is the master of the material realm and the spiritual realm, and he's saying that from that transcendental person, all the universal globes, the universal form, are generated. Yet he is aloof from such material manifestations. He gives an example, like the sun, which is separate from its rays and heat. So, you know, if one follows the instructions of Brahma, he will understand that what was one of the initial questions asked by Parikshit Maharaj and by Narada Muni, that, you know, what is this universal manifestation resting upon? And what is it depending upon? What is it, you know, resting upon? What is it manifested from? Lord Brahma, throughout these prayers, he's saying the Supreme Person is resting on him, on his energies. He never says that, you know, it comes from a void, or that it takes place automatically, or that the living entities within the material the universe are themselves the cause of the material manifestation, and then when they become liberated, they become one with the Supreme. He's not saying any of those different things. He's saying that actually there's a Supreme Person who is beyond the material manifestation, who resides in the transcendental world, which is far greater than what you're seeing in the material world. And that Supreme Lord is the Lord of that abode and this abode, and whether living entities live there or here, he is always the master. He is the person upon which these universal shells, you know, which contain the Virata Rupa, you know, is resting upon and depending upon. Now later, as we said, to prove that, he said that in the beginning I prayed to that person. And then he tells the story how he prayed, you know, and worshipped, and even just to have items of worship, he had to depend upon that universe, the manifestations from that Supreme Person in his you know, universal ingredients, to even just to worship him. He had nothing. He was completely dependent in all respects. So that gives an example, you know. It's interesting, in this chapter and the next chapter, Srila Prabhupada, in a couple of his purports, very strongly instructs one to become detached from sex life. And we should understand here, of course, that Brahma is saying that, you know, that transcendental abode is the abode of persons who are, you know, on that platform. There's also a completely different statement. Some of the Prabhupada says that, you know, unless one becomes free from sex life, it's probably better not to go too far past the sex life. Rinpo understood that until someone comes to grips with the fact that an understanding that this material manifestation can only manifest as the energy of a supreme, intelligent, controlling person. Until a person comes to that understanding, that, you know, foundational understanding that God exists as a person and that we are dependent upon Him, we have a direct, you know, intimate relationship for everything that we do, even for material life or spiritual life. Until that understanding is there, one will have an incorrect understanding of what to do in the material world, an incorrect understanding of how to utilize one's material body, an incorrect understanding of the purpose of life, an incorrect understanding of religion, an incorrect understanding of the utilization of anything in the material world, because one will not understand that everything belongs to God. You know, that's a crucial understanding. Everything belongs to God, so it's all His property. And my husband, my wife, my children, my car, my money, my body, my mind, it's all His. Because it's all His, it's all meant for His pleasure. It's all meant for, you know, to be utilized according to His will. And that He is the supreme friend, that if we actually work in harmony with the Lord, He wants to maintain us just as a parent maintains their children, you know, in a loving relationship. So that understanding has to be there. If one can't understand that, of course, then if people hear about even the Leela avatars, they will find it very difficult to understand, you know, the Leela avatars, how they're even possible, let alone what is their purpose in maintaining that essence of religious principles. What to speak of understanding Krishna's pastimes, where he's, you know, with his cowherd boyfriends and he's running around the forest and he just looks like a little boy, you know, causing all sorts of trouble in Vrindavan. So, you know, therefore, it's essential that a person comes to grip with this philosophy of understanding, yes, I can see how a supreme Lord, a supreme person, must be there, and that's the only way we can get material creation. And if that's a fact, it just gives me a whole fresh outlook of what I'm supposed to be doing in this material world. At that, then one can go on, and ultimately that will mean that a person will understand that the material body is not meant for unrestricted sense gratification, but is meant for controlling the mind and senses to gradually become detached from matter and return to the spiritual world. So that, you know, all those things are essential. In the second canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, having come to grips with that, then one can gradually move on to the third canto, and we'll see at the end of this seventh chapter that again there's just a little introduction, a synopsis of the Leela avatars, you know, which is the next step in a person's understanding. And once we can understand, yes, there is a Supreme Lord and He has created this world, then we can understand, oh, and sometimes He comes to visit in different avatars. What does He do when He visits? And we, you know, here Brahma is pointing out that although the Lord manifests in material creation, He remains transcendental. He never ever becomes in other words, we might think that whatever created the material world must be a material thing. So if there is a supreme being, He must be the supreme material thing, and by His because he has a material qualities, material nature, material energy, he has manifested the material world. And because he's material, he's subject to, you know, the same limitations as everything else in the material world. That's the normal way of thinking. The difficulty is to understand that he's completely spiritual, yet the material world comes from a completely spiritual person. How did he do that? How do you remain completely spiritual and yet have nothing to do with anything material? That's what Lord Brahma is trying to show us. That he is so great. And you know, there are many examples that we see that the sun creates a cloud but is never covered because the sun is just too powerful, too far away, too big to be ever covered by the cloud. But the cloud is able to cover our vision of the sun. So Krishna can manifest the material energy which can cover us, our vision of spiritual reality, so we can't understand the spiritual world or the Supreme Lord, but it is so insignificant it can never cover God. Like that. So these are the things that are being described in essence in this. Any questions on that? That's actually the essential understanding of this whole conversation between Brahma and Narada. What's that? Who composed them? It describes here in this we read in the Purusha Sukta itself, it said in verse 10 of the Purusha Sukta, it says, from that ultimate sacrifice were born the Rig, Sama and Yajas portions of the Vedas along with the seven Vedic meters. So by praying to the Lord, he manifested the universal form, and from the universal form we know manifested sound, including the various transcendental sounds of the Vedas, the various hymns, all of that is actually manifested from the universal form. So these prayers like Purusha Sukta and what have you, their eternal transcendental knowledge and the Lord is actually surrounded by many associates who are personifications of, you know, particular aspects of transcendental knowledge, and those transcendental personalities, they always eternally worship the Lord. And when the universe is manifested, you know, those personalities, in essence, transmit throughout the universe their branches of knowledge, you know, in different sections. They, in the same way, you know, that, you know, you have Goddess Saraswati, if you have the blessings of Goddess Saraswati, you can understand knowledge to certain degrees. There are personalities, even, you know, prior to material manifestation, who are literally controlling the, you know, various aspects of transcendental knowledge. So, you know, these are eternal aspects of knowledge. gradually they take form within sound as the universe manifests in the form of various sages, deities, demigods, and what have you. You know, and they are sometimes, you know, the transcendental sound, of course, is given by the Lord initially to Brahma in a nutshell form, and then gradually, you know, as the universe expands and is populated, that nutshell form of knowledge becomes expanded through different personalities. But it's contained within that nutshell, you know, that. But then, you know, as it becomes expanded, then the various branches of that knowledge manifest as the various, you know, different sections of the Vedas. And some of those sections of the Vedas are then expanded again in different ways. But actually, the Vedas, the Purusha Shukta, the Vedas expand from the Purusha Shukta prayers. It is such a, you know, essential seed form of knowledge that is there from the very beginning of creation. Yeah. But as described there, the various divisions of the Vedas manifested after Brahma's initial prayers. So it doesn't say that he offered these Purusha Shukta prayers in the beginning. You know, in this chapter, describing that Brahma worshipped the universal person, but it's not saying that he spoke the Purusha Shukta. But Brahma, what he is saying to Narada Muni is that in the beginning I had to worship the Supreme Lord, and by worshipping the Supreme Lord, he then became pleased to manifest the universal form along with the various branches of the Vedas. And everything he said there is in the Purusha Shukta. So within each universe, that aspect of transcendental knowledge has to be fulfilled. So, you know, when there's whichever universe, the Lord will appear within there, and then Brahma will manifest, Brahma will worship the Lord, and then the Lord will then reciprocate, and gradually everything will manifest after that. That's a, you know, so we can't leave that step out, that Brahma takes birth, he doesn't worship the Lord. That has to be an essential. The worship, the story of that worship, is what the Purusha prayers are describing. The Purusha Shukta is describing that Brahma worshipped the Lord in the very beginning and had to use the Lord's universal ingredients to worship him because there was nothing else. That's what the Purusha Shukta is saying. And it is also saying that that person who became happy with the worship of Brahma, he then manifested the universal form. And that person is transcendental to the material world and far greater than the material universe. That's what the Purusha Shukta is saying. Describes that whole thing.
So it may change from universe to universe.
No, no, why would that change? In every universe, Brahma would have to manifest and he would have to worship the Lord, but there'd be nothing for him to worship the Lord, so he will have to utilize the Lord's energy himself to worship him. That will have to happen in every universe. And that Lord is always transcendental to the material world and far greater than it. That's the same situation in every universe.
There could be different universes, right?
Yes.
All universes are not the same.
No.
But since you said that, you know, it's a process. Lord worship Brahma and how the Lord gives knowledge back to Brahma, right?
Yes.
Something like that. So probably, so the process is still the same, you mean?
That has to be the same. That's the only way things can work. Yeah, if we don't get the blessing, if we don't ask the Lord to empower us to do something, it can't happen.
So the process is the same, the way it is constructed is different.
No, it's pretty much the same, just a different Brahma. Does everyone understand that? In every universe, right? Yep. Lights. Let's pray the Kavalakshya vision. We have lights. Thank you. Their little universal shell. In every universe, the Lord will enter as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. From his neighbour will come the lotus, and there is Brahma. Brahma then will worship the Lord in order to perform activities in the material world according to his natural inclination, and he will find that there is nothing there to worship the Lord with. As we said, he knows he must worship the Lord because there's a basic understanding that where did I come from? I've come from some far greater force, person. Whatever is available, manifest, you know, and assembled, that hasn't come from me, that belongs to the source of myself and everything else. I must worship that person. And therefore, to worship that person, I must utilize that person's own energy, which is non-different from himself, to worship him because I have nothing else. By pleasing him, then the Lord agrees to reciprocate with Brahma and to manifest the universal form by which Brahma can then go about his activities of creation according to his natural proclivities. That happens in every universe. And the Purusha Shukta describes that event. Not only does it describe that event, but it describes that Lord that Brahma worships is transcendental and beyond the universe. Resides in the three-quarter of spiritual manifestation and is the Lord of that realm as well. He is inspired. Yeah, he's inspired to some degree within the heart. That's not the goddess of knowledge. There is a transcendental Sarasvati who is actually, as we described previously, that the Lord's energy consists of Jnana Shakti or knowledge, and Kriya Shakti, activity, and Ichha Shakti or his will. So yes, that Sarasvati manifesting the potency of Jnana Shakti, that transcendental energy of the Lord inspires Brahma within his heart, and there may be transcendental sound as well to just take the next step. For instance, Brahma takes birth and he's the most pious, elevated person within the universe, basically, and that's why he takes the position of Brahma. So, he takes birth as a very intelligent, person who has natural proclivities and activities. He just needs a little push, and you know, it's not necessarily he's taking birth like a little baby who's crawling around and, you know, doesn't know anything. You know, he's sort of takes birth as a very capable person, but there's just not, you know, he's right at the beginning and everything is dark and mysterious, and he's sort of at the beginning and there's some he needs a little push in his memory and enlightenment and help from the Lord. So, you know, just a little prompting within his heart is enough to push him to the next step, and he just, and then he'll get pushed to the next step, and gradually, you know, everything manifests. So there is some enlightenment that he will hear, and you know, sort of turning on some intelligence within his heart. So that's taken place directly, you know, by the Lord. That's described in the very first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, of course. With that aspect also, we will discuss in this canto, and before we get to the end of the second canto, and we'll also discuss a little bit in the third. So it comes up that whole process of the Lord's reciprocating with Brahma, and exactly what happens, how he gets enlightened. So we understand there is some enlightenment, but there are a lot more details to come. But yeah, he's a very elevated person. It's not, you know, that. You know, for a lot of people in this world, they almost have to train themselves in intelligence and what have you from, you know, after 30 years or something, they come out of university and they're able to think. Brahma's not quite in that category. You know, he's very, 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 you know, he's got a good brain and, you know, good thought process and, you know, but he just needs a little prompting within the heart to just set him in the right direction. So it's a slightly different category to us.
Brahma is using the ingredients from the body of the Lord.
Yep.
What state is that at?
Yeah, look.
There's no universal form, or the universal form?
No, the universal form comes later. This is before. Yeah, this is before.
Yes.
Yeah. But there is here in the Purusha Sukta it describes it as a mental worship. We have to take that also, you know, that this is being done on a very subtle platform. In other words, the Lord does enter with all the necessary ingredients of creation, you know, when he enters the universe, you know, we know that the Mahatattva has been manifested, and the universal shell is actually covered by a layer of Mahatattva. So all the ingredients of the Mahatattva, in essence, are there, you know, as energies of the Lord, sort of that he is able to utilize. So, you know, there's the Purusha Sukta doesn't describe very elaborately this very subtle state of the Lord being there with his, you know, material energies, to such a degree that Brahma can mentally, you know, utilize the Lord to worship him. There's not a lot of description in this chapter, there's not a lot of description in the Purusha Sukta, and I haven't seen a lot of description in other places. There is another place in the 10th canto and also in the 3rd canto where we will discuss where you know, there is something very similar, but at all different stages, you know, either Brahma or the various demigods, they actually have to, you know, propitiate the Lord, to, you know, pray to him, to keep their relationship with him for each and every successive step. In other words, they're incapable of doing anything until the Lord literally, you know, receives their prayers and then sanctions, yes, I will now let you go to the next level of your activities. They can't do anything, you know. They are completely dependent upon him. So there's a couple, we'll come across it, but there are a couple more descriptions like that. There's not a lot of information that I've seen on those, you know, steps. So for our understanding, we have to understand that they're there. It's very difficult to completely conceive of exactly what's there and what's not. But it is a subtle state before the creation of the Virata Rupa. That's one thing. And it's a very important thing, because the Purusha Shukta is such an important prayer, which is recited in, you know, all yagyas and all yagyas, and, you know, it's described as very important. But this sort of event comes up at other parts of creation as well. Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah. What's that? It signifies he's got four brains. Okay. Well, he's yeah. You imagine if you had four heads. You know, you imagine. Because then. I'd get all the essays. Because you'd go home and with one head you'd be sorting out your essays to give to me. And yeah, you'd be doing essays with one. Another head you'd be looking at reading the book and answering your Purva Svadhyaya questions. Another head you'd be getting ahead in the next chapters. And with the other head you'd be spaced out as you normally do. That's why he has four heads. Some Brahmas have many heads. You know, you have two arms. And you know, there are twins you know, who are joined at the brain, and they have the extraordinary ability that one twin can see out of the eyes of the other twins, because they're sharing the same brain. As they like, they can either see out of their own eyes, or if they want, they can see out of the eyes of the other twin, because they're sharing the brain. You know, it's it just gives us a little tinge of understanding how clever the Creator is. But he creates a Brahma with four heads, and you know what he's able to do. Just like, you know, a person has one arm. Like, you know, imagine if I didn't have an arm when I had to ask someone, someone, please turn the page for me. You have two arms, you can pull a book and do this, and scratch yourself with it. So four heads. It gives you a lot of versatility. Okay, so therefore, In the end of this chapter, after describing this whole thing, Hridogand Yavata, I have caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, with great zeal. So he's telling Narada Muni, he begins to explain that, you know, I take shelter of that Supreme Personality's, verse 34, 35, I'm taking shelter of that Supreme Lord who's transcendental and so powerful and actual, you know, he's actually doing everything, you know, and I'm just praying to him for every little thing I can do. And all the ingredients and everything is coming from him, and I can only do anything with his ingredients, his intelligence, by his guidance, like this. And he explains, I'm very, very insignificant. And he says, people may say that they understand the Lord, but I tell you, I can't understand him. He was Brahma, the first created being, the most pious, the most elevated person to get that position as Brahma. Everyone is subordinate to Brahma. He's saying, I can't understand him. If people say they understand him, then, you know, what is their foolish position? And so, you know, he describes to Narada Muni that in verse 37, since neither Lord Shiva nor you nor I can ascertain the limits of spiritual happiness, how can other demigods know it? They're all bewildered by the illusory external energy of the Lord. We can see only this manifested cosmos according to our individual ability. See? Therefore he's saying, as we said, even Brahma doesn't always see the Supreme Person. This verse is describing, mostly he's seeing, he can understand him as far as he can understand how he's controlling the material cosmos and manifesting his energies. So according to his ability, he can perceive the Lord. But, you know, it's quite significant compared to any other living entity within the material universe. But he's saying, I can't understand him, so what can others? And he's also saying even Shiva and Yunira and me, like that. Right? So then he says to him that now that we've discussed this, I will tell you about the transcendental incarnations of the Lord known as Leela avatars. Now basically, by telling him this, the people who take interest in that, they clear their hearts of accumulated mundane filth. We see also at the very end of the seventh chapter that he tells Narada that now I've given you this knowledge, you distribute that. You distribute this Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, all throughout the universe. So in the seventh canto, in the seventh chapter, sorry, he begins to describe the various Leela avatars of the Lord. So he just goes through them quickly. You know, as we said, understanding that yes, there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead and everything in the material creation is his property. It's his creation. It's for his pleasure. It's for his purpose. And his purpose is to reclaim the conditioned souls. Understanding that, now there's a little bit more information about how he does it. He does it through his Leela avatars as well. If we can't understand the first part, all of a sudden Lord Varaha comes and we're thinking, oh, hang on. You know, this has got to be a myth. But you know, if we understand that the Lord is completely transcendental, he can do anyone who can manifest, any person who can make unlimited material universe can easily appear as Lord Varaha. If you can understand that, which person we talk about, that person who by his material energy, which is just a fraction of his glories, can manifest all these material universes. That person appears as Lord Varaha. Oh yes, I can understand that. But if we can't understand that there's a person who creates material manifestation, we cannot understand Lord Varaha. So first understanding first, and then we understand. So these different incarnations, whenever there is some particular anomaly within the Lord's material creation, he himself will appear and rectify that. In this case, the earth fell into, you know, the water. Had to be, that's a big thing. We talked about that once before, about mining. Excessive mining can, you know, shift, upset the floating of the earth in its proper position. So he goes through all the various avatars, and then he comes to Krishna. So just giving a little taste, and then again, just a hint about Krishna. Just enough to understand that he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the full manifestation of God, from whom the Leela avatars are coming, you know, from whom, you know, Garbhadaksha Vishnu, Mahavishnu, and his pastimes will describe in more depth in the 10th canto. So he's just giving us a little bit of a taste, and then he will give more information about that in the successive cantos. And he says, by hearing about those things, if people hear about those pastimes of the Lord, it will attract them away from seeing everything in a mundane way, and it will attract them to be thinking about the Lord in progressive stages of realization, and that will actually get them out of the material world. So that's really a summary of the 6 and 7 chapters of this chapter. Any questions on that? Okay, so I'll just summarize that next week. The size of relief. Is that, no? What we will do is the first half of the lesson, we can go over some, you know, homework questions. Perhaps the one thing that we didn't look at, which we can do very quickly now, is the last open book question. That's the only one we haven't discussed, which is, what is it? Discuss the importance of preserving and distributing the message of Srimad Bhagavatam with reference to 7th chapter verses 51 to 53. How is this mission relevant to you? Five marks for discussing the importance of preserving and distributing the message of Bhagavatam. Two, for giving appropriate references from those verses. And three, for explaining the relevance of this mission for yourselves. It's actually a mood and mission statement. Mood and mission means that one, Prabhupada is unique in, you know, in this spiritual organization. He has an emphasis on book distribution and distributing Srimad Bhagavatam, which is very strong. His mood about that is, you know, very, very strong. And preaching in general and what to preach, that's very strong mood of Srila Prabhupada. You know, if you ask him about maintaining a temple, book distribution, distributing Srimad Bhagavatam, he'll say, yeah, put one or two people, look after the temple, everyone else go out and distribute books. You know, he has that sort of mood. His mission, you know, is that certain problems in the world should be solved by distributing the knowledge of the Srimad Bhagavatam. How does that affect, you know, understanding what are those problems, you know, the mission, what do we have to fix, what do we have to solve, and in what way, does that mean we have to train preachers, we have to train people who are going to be able to distribute the message of Srimad Bhagavatam properly. That's part of the mission. We know from the statements in those verses that a professional person can't do it. So, you know, part of the mission is that we have to make sure that the people who are distributing the message are qualified, that the essential elements of the message are given, you know, to the right people, and they're given in a practical way that certain problems of the world will actually be fixed, as well as the ultimate, living entity, making significant steps on their spiritual path. You know, these are all part of the mission, how to actually go about and fulfill it. Just picking the right statements, and then presenting how is this mission relevant to you? It can be relevant in a lot of ways. We understand, of course, that Lord Rama gave this instruction to Narada Muni, and that we're in the same disciplic succession coming down from Narada Muni. So the same instruction that Lord Brahma gave to Narada Muni is actually the same instruction we're receiving. So it's relevant, it can be relevant in the sense of it's quite a monumental and important mission to be, to actually receive, to inherit, that instruction. So in other words, if we can distribute the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam, we're also serving Lord Brahma's heartfelt desires, which are at the very core of the purpose of why he manifested the whole material creation. So Lord Brahma is very happy, and all the personalities. How else, just some ideas, and how else you may feel it's expressed, how it's relevant to yourselves. How do you take that part? Because of course the opposite of that is, you could think, is it relevant to me? Maybe it's irrelevant. Yes. Yes, and how it's relevant in essence means that should you even bother? Do you need to bother? It's not relevant to me. It's that's for Narada Muni or for the gurus or So in essence, it's asking that question, that do you feel that that's relevant for you? And then and if you say no, why? Or if you say yes, why? Why you feel it's relevant for you? Like that. Okay, so that pretty much finishes that unit.